to the very first episode of the Foodie Flash, Foodie Flashback. Yeah, that's the name of the show. It's a podcast about your food and your like favorite memories attached to that. This very first episode, I think I should probably explain what, like, why I'm doing this and what I'm doing, in case you just haven't listened to the intro that I posted like a couple of days ago. The idea is basically everybody, at least everybody I've met so far, I mean, maybe they're all kind of foodies or like people that just like food in some shape or form, either cooking or eating. But like everybody I've met so far has had like a favorite food or like a comfort food or something that they just have fond memories and stories about, like whether it's, I don't know, your grandma's mac and cheese or their, I don't know, today I like baked something that like my grandma used to bake, and like I there were so many memories and feelings attached to that, and I thought it would be interesting to like talk about that and discover and share that a little bit. And so here we are, and I have with me the one, the only, Doc Rock.
Aloha.
Hi. Yeah, we've done so many podcasts together.
Yeah, it's almost too comfortable. Like I'm supposed to be nervous or like trying to figure out what to do or say, but I talk to you all the time, so it's weird.
it's like, I mean, we're doing this all the time. We're like, we should just record our normal talks. I mean, no, actually, we do. That's called the Mac Show, right?
Yeah, I was going to say, otherwise we might get sued for that.
That's true.
It's been a many year. I just realized the other day that we've been doing that Mac Show podcast for almost 10 years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I mean,
it's crazy.
We've been on podcast for, I think, somewhere close to 8. I think it was 2012. So certainly around 8 years.
Man, that's nuts.
Yeah. I just posted Macworld photos the other day. So long time ago.
Oh, my God. And speaking of foodie flashbacks, that definitely the Urupi Palace. Mm-hmm. And the first time you go to some place that brings you a 2-foot-long paper dosa.
Mm-hmm.
And amazing. The look on everyone's face when it comes out is like, whoa, what is that? And that will go down in history as one of my favorite food memories for a long time.
Yep.
Because here in Hawaii, we don't have that level of Indian restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and what's funny about the first time that I went to Urupi Palace, that wasn't my first time. I believe that was probably like my second or third time.
Yeah, I remember the first time I went
was with Eric Nakagawa, mm-hmm. Famously of the I Can Has Cheeseburgers, and my buddy Umi, John Lewis.
Mm-hmm.
And we were there for Macworld, you know, like a couple years prior. And, you know, John is a vegetarian. And so, like, we were going to the mission to go meet up with Eric because he's from Hawaii, but, you know, living in the Bay. Mm-hmm. And he was like, oh, let's go find you somewhere good that you can eat. And we had those two options, was that place and another place right next door actually called Dosa. And we're like, I'm like in the back of my head, okay, you know, I'm going to cave one in for Umi because he's a good dude. And mm-hmm. I'm going to go eat some vegetarian food. I'm going to kick and scream and I'm going to hate it. But I'm just going to smile and I'm going to nod and I'm going to pretend because that's my boy and I love him. So let's just do this.
Yeah, it's what you do for your friends, right?
And then the food came out. And I remember, like, I always say, you know, my version of the quote-unquote foodgasm is when you kind of do that little head bob, you know, when you eat. Yeah. And of course, no one on the recording can see the motion, but it's the motion a little kid makes when they got to pee. That's about the same motion you make when you eat something that epic. And I was like, man, who knew? Like, I really stopped poo-pooing mm-hmm. vegetarian food from that moment on. And I've had good vegetarian stuff that was mind-bending.
Yeah, that place is definitely, that's still my favorite place in the world, to be honest. Like, and I mean, you told us we should go there, so we went. I mean, obviously, I think we followed you. Like, you had been to San Francisco so many times. Yeah. We just followed you.
Well, we had another, I forgot whether it was Kelly or Barry, but we had another kicker screamer in the mm-hmm. list. And I was like, okay, I can't wait to do this to somebody else.
Yeah, it was fun. It was fun. And I saw that place and I was like, okay, cash only, family run. So I was either it's going to be really bad, but I mean, knowing you, it's probably going to be amazing. And it was like, I mean, the thing is, when food is really good and everybody's enjoying it, there's silence on the table. And that's really, I think that's really funny. Like nobody, like been talking all the time before, and then all of a sudden silence, and everybody's just focusing on the food.
And what's cool about those places is they use, oh, I forgot the name of the word, but the metal, the big metal plates from India. Mm-hmm. There's a word, a thali mm-hmm. or a tally, something like that. All you can hear is the clanking of thali. And then you're like, oh yeah, this is the spot.
Yeah, exactly. Like, and I mean, the people, it's family run. The people were amazing. They were super nice. I remember that. Like we had way too much food and it was way too cheap for the food we got.
Yeah, that's the other part that's quite amazing. You know, not to stretch off topic, but yesterday here locally, we have a place called The Spot, and The Spot is owned by an Egyptian guy who's lived in the U.S. for a long time. Mm-hmm. And his wife is a Japanese national, and they're both chefs, and they themselves cook a lot of, you know, good. I hate the term Middle East, but that's just for lack of a better word. Keep it simple for people's understanding. Mm-hmm. They cook a lot of Middle Eastern / Mediterranean food. And what's amazing is because of their skill of stretching a, you know, otherwise inexpensive items, they were building plates for like 1,000 people to give to the needy, you know, right now while we're on this lockdown. And so we went in just to get food, and I kind of forgot that that was what they were doing. And so you walk in and you saw them lining up. But then it also reminds me that, you know, during college, the reason why that place is so popular here is for $10, you get a plate that's so heavy, you could eat it twice.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's very, very delicious. And it has to do with the level of spices and things. And, you know, the broth, there's a broth or like a soupy texture to just about everything. Mm-hmm. And I'm always amazed at how, with the exception of maybe England, where their national food is a curry, why it doesn't span the globe much, much further. Like there's curries in places, but they're different. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I guess the big one is, you know, the minute that you learn after being a kid, the minute that you learn that curry is not one thing.
Yeah.
It's a bunch of things, and it's, you know, something to do with slow cooking and spices and, you know, and low price ingredients, recipes.
Yeah, exactly. It can have a sauce. It can be dry. Like there's so many different variants of it. It's really interesting. It's something I've found, and I definitely want to explore in this podcast also, is that like the best food in the world is usually the peasant dishes, like the stuff where you didn't have much and you had to make something amazing out of it. And somehow, like, you took the cheapest cuts of meat, or you took the veggies that nobody wanted or whatever, like noodles, whatever you had, and you made something really amazing out of that.
And is that where we stole the Frankfurter from you guys?
Probably, yeah. I don't know.
No, I'm dead serious. Like, I'm curious. Like, I know it's a quote-unquote American thing, but it came from the German immigrants.
Yeah, so, definitely.
They were using the junk pork, right?
Yeah. I mean, that's like you would usually – I mean, nowadays you don't as much. But back in the day, I mean, that's why there are so many different kinds of sausages in Germany, and most of them are the, like, the innards or like the cheaper cuts that like you couldn't do anything else with. A lot of fats as well.
I like the way the Japanese call it, because it sounds so classy. The offal.
Oh yeah.
We made this out of offal.
Yeah, exactly.
They call it harumon, but when they describe what harumon is, they say it's offal. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, that's exactly correct. No one I know says that word. Okay, let me ask you a question, Mrs. Host. What is the typical, like, say, low-budget German soul food, but it's so good anyway?
That's a difficult question. I would say it's probably sausages and sauerkraut, which is also something that a lot of people actually know. But it's like, I mean, sauerkraut is something... It's like it's a cabbage that's preserved, So yes. That's a typical thing that you could eat in the winter. Like you could preserve it in the fall or
it's amazing that summer. Sauerkraut exists in every culture under various names, like kimchi.
It's true.
You know, for
it's
here in Hawaii, idea. Kimchi rules the world. And even in the majority of the Asian countries, because Hawaii is very Asian influenced. And so the majority of the Asian countries, they still use kimchi as their go-to pickled dish. And there's lots of flavor, you know, and it's basically sauerkraut that's spicy.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's really interesting. I mean, I actually prefer kimchi over sauerkraut. Sauerkraut has kind of like one taste, I want to say, like it's one flavor profile. And kimchi is so many different flavors. And like, it's kind of like, it's a spice. It's not really, like, it's not really just like a side dish or whatever. It's a spice in itself.
I think it's heavily misunderstood by the appropriation methods that exist out there. Like there's a lot of people that are using kimchi in dishes because it's on vogue and not necessarily because they understand the kimchi.
Yeah.
I was lucky. I was kind of adopted by Korean family. So like I'm well versed in the kimchi game. And the cool thing I think though now with everyone's understanding of probiotics, that's the reason why it's kind of being appropriated is because, you know, everybody wants to take the probiotics. But considering how much those pills cost and how cheap you can buy kimchi or sauerkraut.
Or make it yourself.
Or make it yourself.
Yeah.
Just learn how to make it yourself. My venture right now is going to be more pickles. I grew up on my grandma's pickles and they were such a good thing. And then I became a store-bought pickler. Yeah. And I was like, that's weird to me. So when you're, you know, talking of, hey, like what's a food memory or something that you would think of, I remember my grandmother used to make all kind of pickle stuff. And we ate it because it could last forever in those jars in the cupboard.
Yeah,
you're And now it's funny, those jars are Kraft.
Exactly. And now they're expensive. Like back in the day, they were cheap. Like you could get them everywhere and they were like cheap and everybody had like a million of them. And now they're expensive. Like it's really funny.
I distinctly remember her boiling the empty jars in a big pot. And I was like, why is Granny cooking jars? I was a little kid, you know, I'm like 6 or 7 years old. I'm like, why is she cooking jars? And she's like, oh, I'm sanitizing them. I'm like, for Christmas? And she's like, get out of here. Get out of the kitchen. But I the reason why, and I know you brought this up in the beginning, the reason why I'm a foodie is I was probably grandma's boy. And, you know, amongst the cousins and the siblings and stuff, for whatever reason, I was hyper attached to my grandma. Probably because she cooks so good now that I'm thinking about it. But when you're a little kid, you don't know, you know. And then so even though she would always try to shoo me out the kitchen, I was right there by the apron strings. And then after she realized that she wasn't going to get rid of me, she started putting me on, you know, like here, pull these ends off the beans or take the, you know, that string on the back of the string beans. Pull this out, you know. And then when I discovered, oh, this is cool. You can pull this out. You know, and the science lover in me would freak out, you know. And then I think I fell in love with cooking partially because of, again, being grandma's boy. And the other part would be I discovered the science in cooking. And to this day, I still cook from a science perspective. My food hero will always be Alton Brown because he was the first person that I know of that put science and cooking on the map for the general population.
How old were you when, like, your first memory as a kid, like in the kitchen, like pulling out those beans or like those strings?
I want to say probably like 5 or 6 years old. You know, like my first memory of the kitchen is busting my head because I tried to get to the toaster to make a Pop-Tart and I couldn't reach. And so being the genius that I was, I opened the drawer and then I opened the oven door and I created steps so that I can climb onto the counter. And then right when I got to the top, I got my Pop-Tart in, I put the thing down and I was standing in the top drawer. And I don't think you could do that now, kids, because drawers are made out of fiberboard. You'll probably break your butt. But like back in the day, cabinets were made out of actual wood.
Yeah.
And so I remember I'm watching the heat in the toaster. I'm watching my Pop-Tart go. And then I heard, hey, boy, get the, and a bunch of bad words off of that. And I went to go turn around. And for whatever reason, the drawer came out and I went flying.
No.
And then so in that drawer was like all the pot holders and the coupons and, you know, like mail and all that stuff. So it went flying all over the kitchen and I ended up sprawled on the kitchen floor. And, you know, back in the day, it wasn't like, oh, he's hurt. Let me take that. Back in the day, it was, I'm still going to kick your butt for doing what you weren't supposed to do. And I discovered the wooden spatula.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that was my probably first memory of the kitchen. But for whatever reason, even with the spanking, I was never coming out of that kitchen.
Yeah. Yeah, it's, I mean, it's really funny. I mean, when you mentioned that, like, you learned cooking from your grandma. I've heard that a lot. Like, a lot of people don't learn too much from their parents and more from their grandparents for whatever reason. And it's not, I don't think it's an age thing because, I mean,
yeah, even today, but I think of our age at the time, you know, grandparents were daycare more back then than now because we've sprawled out a lot more. In Hawaii, it's very much so grandparents are daycare because we don't have the sprawl. We're tight, you know, community.
Exactly.
And I think it's just because you happen to be there, you know, when you're a child.
Sure, yeah. I mean, your parents were at work and your grandparents had time. So, yeah, that makes sense. For me, it was
actually,
more
my
like
mom didn't really pick up cooking because my grandmother. So when it came time to cook, once I turned about 10, I became the cook for the house. Mom never really picked it up because she was the first, you know, college girl and working and.
Yeah.
You know, at that time, you know, right after Vietnam, you had to have two jobs kind of thing.
Yeah. It was also the time of like the prepared meals, like microwaves came into play and stuff like that. So I have a feeling that has something to do with that.
Oh, yes. I grew up on TV dinners. And then I remember eating the we call green beans or someplace called wax beans. I remember eating like green beans or wax beans in the TV dinner. And I think I distinctly remember, like, this don't taste like grandma's.
You know, exactly.
What the heck is this?
Yeah.
And then my mom was like, shut up, eat it. You know. And the other thing that's so thankful, I'm pretty sure has gone away. That's because I don't look for it. Maybe it does exist. Clarence Birdseye in the U.S. basically created the frozen brick of vegetable.
Right? I think you can still get them.
You're talking about like a 6-inch box by about 2 inches thick by about 4 inches. So it looked like a postcard.
Yeah.
And then you open it and out would come this homogeneous glob of spinach, corn, green beans, like whatever side dish you needed, you could buy it. And then you just basically drop it in hot water.
Yeah. I think you can still get them. I've seen them somewhere.
Oh, they were horrible because it became waterlogged. So
yeah, exactly.
I grew up as a kid hating vegetables because that's what I grew up eating was that sort of vegetable. And so when I would see the greens, you know, my grandma would make greens. And when I would see the greens, I would never eat them. And I always thought they were rubbish or Brussels sprouts.
Oh, yeah.
And then now Brussels sprouts is the hipster love.
Yeah. Yeah,
and that's when they're not cooked in water.
Yeah, I think to be that definitely. Yeah, I mean that's one of the things I definitely cannot eat Brussels sprouts. I mean, like, on occasion I've eaten them, but like my mom and my grandma and like my grandparents, they used to cook them in water, and that was horrible. I mean, as a kid, you don't like the taste of Brussels sprouts anyway because they're slightly bitter. But then, like, if they're like bitter and mushy, like no.
I think the greatest discovery past the age of 40 is that bitter is good.
Mm-hmm. That's true. I mean,
your taste buds have to come around to it, you know?
Yeah, it is exactly. I had Brussels sprouts somewhere in Phoenix like a couple of months ago, and they were really good. And I was like, oh, wow, okay. Maybe I'm missing out.
Yeah, so I've been purposely trying to challenge myself to eat things I swore that I didn't like as a kid. And it turns out I like a lot more of them than I thought. One thing that's trippy, okay, for instance, I wish that both my mom and my grandmother were alive to see my love for cabbage. Mm-hmm. Because as a kid, I'd taken full on ass whoopings because I wouldn't eat cabbage because cabbage was nasty. But they were taking the frozen stuff and boiling it, and it was disgusting.
Yeah.
Right. So here, shout out to my homie Chris Kajioka, a great chef. He makes a cabbage wheel. So imagine cutting like an inch and a half thick slice of cabbage, almost like a steak. Right. And you char that bad boy in a cast iron skillet for probably around 20, 30 minutes.
Yeah.
And you flip it over and you char the other side and you put a small mixture of sugar and salt on the top. And when both sides are well burned, like they create the Maillard reaction or whatever, he slaps it on a plate and he creates this amazing like foam powder substance that goes on the top of it. And that charred cabbage is one of the greatest inventions ever.
Yeah.
And I could never imagine myself eating that much cabbage. And then it dawns on me, you know, when I go home and I'm talking to my sisters that I eat kimchi damn near daily. I always love coleslaw, even as a kid when I swear to God I hated cabbage, but I loved coleslaw.
It's funny how kids are like that. It's like, oh, this is not cabbage, this is coleslaw.
Yeah, it's different, right? And then eating the charred cabbage. And then what's now even more amazing is once you go to a Japanese restaurant to like a tonkatsu or another place called a kushikatsu. Now, a katsu is a Japanese word for cutlet. It's cutletsu is how they pronounce cutlet. And it just got shortened to katsu. So any type of cutlet, they normally slice it, serve it warm on a bed of cabbage. And then what is known as katsu sauce, or what you can buy in a grocery store as bulldog sauce, is like a combination of, I want to say like Worcestershire, ketchup, barbecue sauce, and mustard all mixed together.
Yeah, sounds, what sounds is known all right. Yeah.
Like bulldog sauce. And when you pour that over, that drips down onto the cabbage with the fat from the fried cutlet and the juices from which, whether it's pork or chicken, which is the most common in cutlets, although there are beef cutlets. And then in the end, it becomes like this fantastic little slaw salad move.
Exactly.
Right.
It's I've had it when I was in Hawaii and like, I mean, it sounds strange.
Oh, you did?
It sounds
simple. Did you go to Tamafuji or
Tamafuji.
Oh, you went to, you know that.
Yeah,
you
know.
Tamafuji. Oh, God. I just had a moment. Sorry. and it cool, the great part about cabbage, just to show you about that thing about being cheap, in restaurants where they do serve cutlet in Japan, is the cabbage and the rice are continuous, right? So as you run out, you can just keep asking for more. So the other way that they do it, instead of just giving you that the bulldog sauce or the tonkatsu sauce, is they'll also serve it what's known as a wafu, which is a Japanese dressing, like a vinaigrette. And, oh, man.
It's, I think people it's, are it's getting moving. Hungry now.
Yes, it's quite a moving experience. So I think to me that I wish everyone could have an opportunity to taste that, but I would just love for my mom and my grandmother to see how much cabbage I eat nowadays. They would be mind blown.
Yeah. Because
there was fights. There was corporal punishment. There was running around trying not to get hit because I figured out, I learned that I was faster than them. There was hiding under the table. There was feeding into the dog, and then there's dog farts.
Been there, done that.
Yeah, all of the above. And like now it's one of my favorite foods. It's so crazy.
I had the same thing with spinach, like the same thing. It like it usually came in a brick and it didn't, like once my mom had cooked it, it didn't taste like much other than it was a little bit bitter. So I was always like, I don't like spinach. And then I tried fresh spinach first and like made it with like a pasta dish, I think. And I was like, wow, that's actually amazing. And then I tried it as a salad, like that was good. I was like, okay, maybe I'm missing out. And like now I'm a big fan of spinach. Like I'll throw it in anything. So it's the same thing.
I didn't know that the frozen brick of vegetables came past the US. I didn't know
that it existed other places. Yeah, no, you could. It's probably even the same company at this point. Like, I think they're just a global player. And like, you can buy that here in a store.
Still,
and it's still the same horrible thing.
it was for here. It was Bird's Eye and then Jolly Green Giant. Mm-hmm. But then what made it just absolutely special? You know, our stores, our retail chains are your Kroger's and your Safeway, your Ralph's. Ralph's, Kroger, and Safeway is actually the same store across the U.S. and Albertsons. It's just named something different depending on where you live.
Yeah.
They always had their in-house brand that was even worse than the Bird's Eye or the Green Giant. But back in the day, I distinctly remember them being $4 for a dollar.
Mm-hmm.
So they were cheap. And then if they were on sale, they were like $6 for $1.
Yeah. And I mean, as a crafty mom that like doesn't have too much budget, like you buy that.
And then the step up, I don't know if you remember this, the step up is when it would come in a plastic bag and you could boil the whole thing in the plastic bag because it came with like a sauce.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Like the broccoli with the cheese. It's not even cheese. I don't know what it is. It's some kind of like weird orange substance.
Cheese-like substance.
cheese sauce. So it would be like broccoli and it would be a collaboration with Kraft. Mm-hmm. So it'd be Velveeta.
Oh,
and then you pull the little pouch out and you boil it. And then the other one was what's known as a Salisbury steak, which is basically a chuck steak, and it would be in this gravy, and you boil that whole thing in the bag. And so literally dinner time was mom would get out the scissors and cut open these two bags and just brah.
Yeah. And, like, and dinner. You know what? That is popular as well now. I mean, the whole sous vide technique and everything.
Yeah. We didn't know that sous vide back then. We knew that as nasty crap in a plastic bag. But yes, that is exactly right.
Yeah, stuff is coming back. As I said, that those bags you could still buy today. I mean, that is still around.
Here's one you got to try. Yeah. If they have the brand there, it's called Stouffer's here. I'm sure, you know, these brands are all global, so they're probably
under a
different name, which is funny because the Stouffer's is already German, so why would they change it? we had, was it chipped beef? And then so what it was like is thin sliced beef, and it comes in a cream sauce. And so why that was a favorite is because both my dad and my grandpa were military, and they had SOS in the service, right? And I want to, for your explicit tag, I won't explain what SOS is, but the other two words are on a shingle, meaning a piece of toast. And then so when you got the Stouffer's cream chip beef, I don't even know if it was good or not, but I liked it because I figured I was following in my grandpa and my dad's footsteps with being a soldier, and this is soldier food. So I always wanted to eat that cream chip beef on toast. And then now that's converted into my love for sausage biscuits and gravy, which is basically the same thing, but slightly different, more with sausage instead.
Yeah. It's funny, like how sometimes the bad stuff is what sticks with us. I mean, I have that with my kids right now where, like, I mean, mac and cheese, that's why I bring up mac and cheese a lot, because that's like one of the things we cook a lot. But it has to be Kraft Velveeta mac and cheese. Like, it can't be I once tried to make good mac and cheese and they didn't like it. They wanted the Kraft, the crappy ones. So it's
The fluorescent mac and cheese?
Yeah. It's like,
what?
It's like, why? I didn't get it. I'm like, why? But like, that's the stuff people remember. Like, if it has to be mac and cheese, it has to be that. Like, it can't be the good kind or any other kind. No, it has to be exactly that one. So it's really funny how our memories work.
Yeah, I guess you're right. Because I think that Emma actually loves the fluorescent mac and cheese.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know what it is about it.
At Thanksgiving, my girl Eddie, she makes, you know, real mac and cheese, you know, and I've made real mac and cheese for Thanksgiving. And I don't think that goes over. Actually, I sent you my mac and cheese recipe way back when we first started being friends.
That's true.
And that mac and cheese recipe is legit. But yeah, I guess if you grew up on the blue box.
Yeah, it's super, super funny. Like how our memories and our feelings get attached to that. And like, I mean, in case my kids, like not 20 years later or 30 years later, but in our cases, like 20 years, 30 years yet later, we still crave and remember exactly that. Like I said, there might be better options, but we're like, no, it has to be exactly this brand, this crappy version that I got as a kid.
Okay, I found it. In Germany, it's probably still Stouffer, but I'm going to say it in English. It's Stouffer, S-T-A-U-F-F-E-R.
Stouffer.
And S-T-O-V-E-R. Because that's the correct pronunciations. In the U.S., we say Stouffer's, but it's how you say?
Stouffer.
There you go. It sounds like Topher.
It kind of is, yeah.
Hey, Topher. I'm going to start calling him Stouffer. He's going to be like, what? So that's so it is the same Nestle brand even in Germany, and it's probably just pronounced right. Because I was like, the name itself is probably German in the first place or Swiss in the first place.
Maybe, yeah. Something like
even
that.
Nestle, right? Nestle is Swiss.
Nestle is, French Swiss.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah. I think I grew up not too far from a Nestle factory. So
they have Nestle in Koblenz?
No, there was like at the Swiss border, actually.
Oh.
Yeah. So nice. I want to circle back to something that you mentioned at the beginning regarding your grandma. I want to talk a little bit about like pickling or like preserving. Did you do like, did she grow her own stuff and like pickle it with you or preserve it with you?
Most dev. I was responsible for the tomatoes at the bottom. Because I was short, you know, and at that time, you know, her back's already hurting, you know, because she's an old lady. Sure. And my grandma was a nurse. And and then so she was on her feet all the time and then bending over, changing diapers and doing all of the nursely type stuff.
Yeah.
Right. And that's then as she became older, she became a private nurse for this sort of wealthy Jewish family. And you know, they were super, super nice to her. So I didn't realize it, but all of a sudden, a lot of the like sort of Jewish German food became part of our diet because the lady would always, you know, have my grandma making things for her that matched what, you know, she sort of ran away from Germany.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. That makes sense.
And yeah. So one of the things, I guess, that, you know, my grandmother was a farm girl in the first place. So yes, we definitely grew stuff in the back. And I remember I loved just pulling the tomato off the plant and splashing a little salt on that bad boy and just eating it like an apple. I was a tomato apple kid.
Me too. Absolutely.
And then the other one I thought was weird was the little red, there's these little red plants, and like, these are cool, they're so bright, this is great. Oh my god. And my grandmother, she basically fell out in the garden and she was laughing so hard because she did it. I think she was trying to tell me not to do what I was fitting to do, but you know, you're no kids. So I was like, Granny, look, this one is so bright red, this is gonna be really good. It's a skinny tomato. Like, that you just brought back a very hilarious memory for me.
Oh yeah, that is funny. Yeah, and I mean, the stuff tasted great. I mean, I don't know whether it was because it was with your grandma or whether it was simply because she had grown it. Like, it was fresh compared to the stuff that you usually buy in the store. But like, it tasted amazing. I mean, I remember like my grandma used to grow like tiny little like cherry tomatoes. And like every morning or whatever, I would go outside and just pick one or two or just off the plant and just eat them, and they were amazing. And like that's something I still remember to this day, and I still compare every cherry tomato I buy and eat to that one that I like had there.
You know, it's funny, like I tend to not really fall in love with the conversations about, you know, our food mechanism and how bad it is and things like that, because
me neither.
Because it's difficult. Like, I grew up poor, so I know what it means to eat the over homogenized, over processed food, because that was what we could afford at the time, you know?
That was still is to this day, the cheap stuff.
To this day, the stuff that's bad for you.
Yeah.
But I was lucky enough to do the college stint in Japan. And then now, when I go to Japan, and I remember of all of the myriad beautiful things of Japan, I remember the first trip where I was going with Karen together. Mm-hmm. I was like, I can't wait for you to eat vegetables. And she probably looked at me like, what are you like, talking what? About? It's just vegetables.
Yeah.
Japan, for whatever reason, they respect their vegetables way too mm-hmm. much mm-hmm. and their fruit, their produce in general. They mm-hmm. respect their produce almost like a God level, mm-hmm. lowercase g. So they don't, they don't mess with it. Like, it has to be pristine. They yeah. treat it the way people in Westminster treat their labradoodles, right? Everything is yeah. paid attention to, every mm-hmm. detail, the food, talking to them, covering them up with bags so that the birds don't get them. Mm-hmm. For instance, just to show you a hyper focus, when they do grapes, about 300 grape pods grow onto the end of the vine. Mm-hmm. They go and cut all but 30. Mm-hmm. They hand cut in an entire field. All but 30. So those mm-hmm. 30 become these gigantic inch and a half, full flavored, fully yeah. sweet grapes. Instead of they just grow them all and then take the rest and chop it up and turn it into juice, they don't do that. Like, they yeah. behave, they treat it differently. So when you speak of tomato, I forgot what tomatoes tasted like until my stint in Germany, I mean in Japan. Mm-hmm. And when I tasted a tomato again for the first time, like, it almost will bring a tear to your eye when you realize what really fantastic produce tastes like. And for the listeners in the U.S., the closest that you'll get to that here is probably Portland. And that sounds crazy, but Portland has made an arrangement with Sapporo about 20, 30 years ago to be a sister city. So mm-hmm. they started adopting some of those Japanese growing techniques. Mm-hmm. And the farmer's market in Portland will give you toe-curling experience with basic fresh vegetables.
Yeah, I think that's in general. Like, if you can find a really good farmer's market with, like, local farmers, that's where you have the biggest chance of getting, like, really good, well-tended, like, well, like, really tasty produce in general.
I'm glad to see it's making a comeback.
Yeah.
And I am. If you're lucky enough to do so, you have to try it. Like, you got to give up the grocery store one time mm-hmm. and then go to your CSA or your farmer's market mm-hmm. and get some of that fresh, fresh local produce and just yeah. start tasting things that you used to not like again. Like, I still mm-hmm. can't do broccoli. It's texture. It's not flavor. Mm-hmm. Some reason, the little pieces, yeah. I can't polish that one, but mm-hmm. I want you to go because of your love for food. I want you to go to Japan so bad because mm-hmm. I just want to sit back and watch the look on your face. I'm like, oh, you think you just got those curls done? Yo, those curls mm-hmm. would tighten up. You're like, whoa, this food is so good.
Oh yeah. No, that definitely happens. I mean, like, wherever I go, like, the farmers markets are my first stop. Like, London, first time I had to go to Borough Market, the first thing I looked up in Phoenix was, like, where are the farmers market? They had, like, luckily we have, like, I don't know, 7 or 10 of them, and they're all good. So it, like, didn't matter. But I went to it, like, every weekend, every Saturday morning, went to the farmers market, picked up some whatever vegetables were, like, available in season. And, like, that, I still do that. Like, it's super important for me. So I'm definitely going to do that, like, go to Japan.
You know what I've been wanting to do? Because you speak of food memory, mm-hmm. Another love of mine that I got from my grandma that I didn't really realize until we're having this conversation. So thank you, first and foremost. My grandma had a love for that. Nothing happens before that cup of coffee. Mm-hmm. Nothing. Absolutely nothing. Mm-hmm. So if you were to wake up in the morning and the house is on fire, grandma would be like, hold that thought. I'm going to drink this coffee and I'll put a hose on it. Because... like, my grandma would wake up in the morning and have her cup of coffee, read mm-hmm. her newspaper, check the bullets in her gun. Mm-hmm. Like the basics, you know, yeah. the absolute basics for a hood grandma. And then so I remember probably at way too young an age now, which probably we considered child abuse. I think I started drinking coffee with grandma like around 8, 9, or 10, you know.
Yeah, something and like that.
She yeah. would give me, she would go out and get the little thing of decaf mm-hmm. and at the time I remember instant was becoming big, you know. I remember the old pot where mm-hmm. it was the Hill Brothers or Maxwell House or Chock mm-hmm. Full of Nuts mm-hmm. And I remember because we always had the cans. The cans were always full of something other than coffee after the fact.
Yep.
That's where I discovered bullets. I was like, what are these, Grandma? Put that away. Don't touch that can. So I remember that I would sit with her and I would see these commercials on TV about International House Viennese coffee.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the cappuccino. So it was like instant cappuccino or instant Viennese coffee.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember falling in love with it. It tasted so good, but it was crazy expensive. Mm-hmm. And so it almost became like, oh, you did good in school. Let me get one of these for you so you can have coffee with grandma in the morning.
Oh, nice.
And so now that I know better and I know where Vienna is and not just that's where the classical music guys came from, I want to go and have an actual, like, you know, Viennese coffee in honor of coffee with, you know, Sarah May in the morning.
Yeah, we should do that
and together. Just curious as to, like, you know, what kind of taste they would have, like what the real deal, because I only have ever tasted the rubbish instant stuff in a can.
Mm-hmm. No, we should definitely do that together, like have a coffee and like a Sachertorte, which is like a very famous cake from Vienna.
Is that the one with the lines, like lots and lots of lines?
Exactly, chocolate and everything. Like it's
They call it a Venetian or something here.
Yeah, so like,
so something dumb like that, but it's basically a lot of lines, and then so it's like white chocolate up into like a stack.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's like it's amazing, and we'll do that.
Yeah, and then I, again, you know, not that I sit around, and I'm not going to act like I sit around and listen to it all day, but I've always, just because of being a kid, and maybe from that first book report that I had to do on Schubert, I liked classical music, you know, and so I would love to hear it in a real, like, Viennese hall.
Mm-hmm.
Like one of my friends, she flies for Japanese airline, but she's stationed there.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, even for her, she's like, I grew up, I never would have thought I would like classical music, but it's everywhere here. Like, it's part of the culture.
Yep.
And I was like, really? That sounds weird, but I guess it's true. So,
I mean, it's like other cities that have like have strong ties to music. Like, I'm trying to remember, like,
jazz in New Orleans.
Yeah, for example. Yeah. It's like,
or
it's
hip-hop just everywhere. In New York.
Yeah, definitely. Like, it's just everywhere. And, like, it's the same. I mean, I'm not too far from Vienna, like about an hour, and like you can even feel it here. It's definitely there.
That's cool. That's cool.
Do you have like a recipe, like a favorite that you would like to share that I could put like on the podcast?
Oh man, there's so many.
I know it's difficult. Like I'm always struggling. I'm like, I have a recipe.
You know what I've been falling in love with? I've been falling in love with the lockdown. Everybody is on this things that you can make out of three ingredients, and like they're super, super simple and they're delicious, right?
Yeah.
So probably when I was going to school in Japan, one of the greatest things ever is known as like the beef bowl.
Mm-hmm.
And you can make it with pork, you can make it with chicken, you can make it with any of the above. But it's basically a tare, which is a combination of soy sauce, mirin, which is like a sweetened sake.
Mm-hmm.
Sake is sugar and water. That's the sauce. It's basically equal parts of all of that.
Yeah.
And you create the sauce. And then you take a very thinly sliced beef.
Mm-hmm.
And you get it going in a pot for just like a quick minute, right when it starts to change color, the pink has come out, you pour the tare in, and because of the sugars and that in there, it gets a little thick.
Mm-hmm.
And then you drop some onions in that, and you basically pick that up and drop it on a bowl of hot rice.
Mm-hmm.
In Japan, because of their eggs are so amazing, they'll crack a raw egg on the top.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of countries, like, we're against raw eggs because they're so heavily commercialized that you can't. It's probably not safe to eat raw eggs. Yeah. Luckily, we have a Japanese egg farm here, so ours are pretty epic.
Yeah.
But and what's amazing about this is if you go to one of the chains like Yotsunoya or Matsuya or Sukiya, those are the three, you can get that bowl as probably about 800-900 grams, and it's the topping, you know, the beef, pork, or chicken. Mm-hmm. It's a couple pieces of ginger, green onions, and rice. And mm-hmm. you're talking like $4 or $5 for that bowl.
Mm-hmm.
So as a college kid, it is 24 hours a day, right? Yeah. They're open.
That's perfect.
You see nothing in there but transient workers, workers on the hustle, mm-hmm. dudes that just came. If you're early in the morning, dudes that just came from drinking and got to sober up before work,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
and college students.
Yep.
And to show you how efficient these places are, you roll in, you drop, say, 500 N coin, which is like a big quarter. You mm-hmm. drop it in the machine. A little ticket comes out.
Mm-hmm.
By the time you take off your jacket and put your umbrella away and sit down, somebody comes running out of the back with your bowl. And then they serve it with a miso soup
mm-hmm.
and a hot tea or nice. Cold tea if you want it.
Yeah, that's perfect.
And it is hands down yeah. one of the greatest things you will ever eat mm-hmm. and it's so inexpensive and it's so cheap and it's so delicious and anyone can make it.
Yep.
And so I can put together the ingredients for you and send it to you.
Oh, absolutely.
Or you can just look up standard like Japanese beef bowl. That's mm-hmm. called the gyudon. The actual name is gyudon, G-Y-U-D-O-N. Gyu meaning beef, don meaning bowl.
I think so, I've seen that somewhere.
Well, because I sent you the recipe for oyakudon, mm-hmm. right? The oyakudon is chicken yep. and egg bowl, right? Yep. The oya is parents and mm-hmm. the ku is child, right? So parent, child, bowl, oyakudon. It's really, really creepy, Japan. Hello.
really creepy, but really good.
It's really good. That is like the serious sofu. That warms the body mm-hmm. on a mm-hmm. on a cold day. It warms the body. It, mm-hmm. it will shake your soul. It's so delicious.
Yeah.
And again, so easy to make, right? The tare is there, the same basically recipe.
Mm-hmm.
And you slightly let the onions go in it until they become soft. You know, mm-hmm. you're on a low roiling. Okay, English. Low rolling boil. There we go. That's so hard to say. Until once the onions get a little soft and transparent, you drop in some chicken mm-hmm. thigh until they're done. And at the very end, you just pour a beaten egg over the top for just a split second until mm-hmm. it starts to solidify. And you're done. And you just put that on rice.
And then so amazing.
A little tear comes out your eye when you're eating it. It's so good.
Yeah. That sounds amazing. I'll definitely put that. I'll put a link in the show notes.
You made that video for YouTube. I think you made it. And I remember I was watching. Yeah. I couldn't understand a word you were saying, except for when you would say Doug Rock. But I do remember you making that video mm-hmm. on YouTube. So you can link your old video to this post.
Yeah, I'll do that too. But I'll also do the what was it called now?
Gyudon.
Yeah, I'll definitely link that. Gyu.
It's almost exactly the same. Mm-hmm. You're just kind of substituting beef or pork for mm-hmm. that. And then if you can't get thinly sliced, you could do it with the ground meat.
Mm-hmm.
You can, you know, basically just brown off the ground meat.
Yeah, and then that works.
Pour it in with mm-hmm. the, you know, sort of translucent onions and the yeah. sauce. And you just let it thicken just a touch. You don't want to get mm-hmm. too thick because that sauce getting down into the rice is mm. where the actual love comes
yes.
in.
I mean, rice is amazing anyway, especially when it's well prepared. It's really interesting how hard it is to really prepare it, or how easy it is and how many people still mess it up. Let's put it that way.
Do you have a Japanese style rice cooker yet?
No, that's something that's on very much on my list, but they are harder to get here.
Oh, yeah. And naturally, I understand yeah. that. One thing that you might look up on Amazon is see if you can find it's called a donabe. It's mm-hmm. D-O-N-A-B-E. And what it is a clay vessel.
Mm-hmm.
And you can make similarly that steamed Japanese style rice in the mm-hmm. donabe. That's how it was originally done. The electric mm-hmm. version is like the new.
Yeah.
But you could probably pick up a donabe, let's say like a 1.5 liter donabe for probably like around $30.
Mm-hmm. That's not too bad.
And then do you have electric or gas?
Induction, also electric.
Oh, they don't really work on induction because they're made out of clay. So
yeah, you can still get it. There are those like little plates that you can put
the plates, right? Yeah. What we do is we got a little teeny gas camp stove. They're also Japanese. The gas comes in a can. It looks like hairspray. And it's known as the Iwatani burner. And you can buy those from Amazon as well. They're really, really popular. And they're good to have because it's a low flame. It's not really dangerous or anything. They're good to have in the house because there are certain things that you just need to cook with fire. And so what I mostly use it for is cooking in a donabe, and I use it for when you want to brown a bell pepper real fast. Or I use the torch. But I don't like the torch because the torch can impart, you know, splash gas flavors if you go too hard.
Yeah, you don't want that. Yeah. No, that's pretty cool. I said I'll put that. I put all those links and like whatever links I can find for what we talked about in the show notes. That will be at foodieflashback.com/1 because this is the very first
episode. It's really cool. It's really, really cool. Like this, it brings back some good memories and make me hungry.
Same. And we never talk about, like, we usually talk about tech and all of that. And like, it's kind of refreshing to talk about something else, right?
Something different than tech.
Exactly. Like, I mean, we do that every week and we've been doing it, as we like said at the beginning, for years and years and years. And now we can talk about something else. I don't know. Do you have anything else you want to share?
I just say it's a really good idea. And I can't wait to listen to hear sort of what, you know, the going foods are around the world. If people out there listening need any inspiration, you know, Ugly Delicious is an amazing show and the exploration of food. I guess recently since Alton Brown became very interested in food anthropology.
Yeah, me too.
You know, and I think that's what sparked my quote unquote hashtag foodie. Like, I would have been considered a hungry person prior. But once you started understanding the history and like how these things came about and like how, you know, tempura is so popular in Japan, but yet that came from Portugal. But it's kind of the national food of Japan, you know, or like the ramen came from China kind of thing. And it's interesting, you know, like even for us, like I said in the very beginning, ours is hamburgers and hot dogs, both of which we stole from Germany.
I mean, everybody's kind of stole from everyone to some extent. I mean, potatoes, like very, like I always say Germany is, for example, meat and potatoes. Potatoes aren't indigenous in Germany. Like they came from South America. So it's like really funny, over the centuries, like we've kind of, everything has kind of mixed and moved, and someone saw something, it was amazing, and took that idea and brought it somewhere else and like all of that. And then like spices came into play. Like it's really like trade and all of that. And like talking to people, like what we do, it inspires people to.
Well,
like,
even the contrast of how you make it yours, right? You take what's available and you have to convert it. So like I'm sitting here giving you this long lecture about tonkatsu. And I just realized my first tonkatsu ever in the world wasn't a tonkatsu. It was a Wiener Schnitzel.
That is true, yeah, and it's very, it is to some extent similar, and then again, it's not.
Yeah, it's different. Like, it's different. When I was stationed in Stuttgart, I don't know if I say that correctly.
Yeah,
you do. Yeah, when I was in Stuttgart, and I had my first Wiener Schnitzel, or the other one is Pepper Schnitzel or Ram
Schnitzel. Yep. Jäger Schnitzel. There's so many schnitzels here. As I said, Germany, meat and potatoes, right?
Oh my goodness. See, I didn't even realize that. And what is the egg stuff on the side?
Spätzle.
Yep. Käsespätzle,
yeah.
Oh,
I know Jerry makes them like in Hawaii every now and then. Oh. Like his version.
Man. Yeah. Good.
I think we need another two episodes. One about where we only talk about Japan and one where we only talk about Germany.
I just now I'm going to be wanting to eat Käsespätzle. A lingonberry tort at the end.
I can send you the recipe for that. Käsespätzle is actually easy to make. So
see,
it's again one of those things that's fairly simple, fairly easy to make, cheap, but just so good. Actually, that's
highlight. What's the simple and cheap thing from where you're from or currently where you're at that other people would think is mind-bending, but it's actually super simple.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'll put that in the show notes as well. We'll put that out on Twitter and like ask people. I want to know that. Like, I'm super interested in stuff like that. Like the cheap and simple and so, so good stuff in the world. And everybody okay, has
on
one.
On an ending note, you want to know still to this day what my favorite food in the world is? And you're probably going to laugh. It's a 50-50 split between grilled cheese and peanut butter and jelly sandwich.
Mm-hmm. I totally get that. For me, it would be a PB&J.
It's so weird, right? Yeah. Like I travel all around the world to eat these fantastic foods, and if you gave me like a split decision on any given day, fresh bread PB&J, mm-hmm. crunchy, mm-hmm. on, and then recently discovered butter it and slightly fry it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah,
exactly. Game over.
Yeah, it's crazy, like. It's like, I mean, I discovered PB&J maybe 10 years ago, and I still like it's still one of my favorite things. It's really funny. Like,
it's such a simple thing, but it's mind bending. Oh, that's funny. Cool. Like, I really appreciate this. It's a great idea. I can't wait to see what other people have to say.
Me too.
And then I'm probably going to gain a lot of recipes out of this.
If it's only recipes, it's good.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you for being here. Thank you for doing this. Like I was kind of trying to figure out like who I could invite first, like to get like an easy start and like someone interesting to talk to. And I was like, okay, let's ask Chuck. Like
you got to call up Chuck.
Oh yeah. I'm going to do that.
Chuck in Portland. Like when mm-hmm. I went to go visit, he took me to the best places. Oh, like Karen and I would just go to places, and at first, like, should we go here? Or should we go here? And Chuck was like, oh, you should go here because this is better. Mm-hmm. And then we would go, and we're like, man, Chuck took us to the greatest places, and probably one of the best meals I've had in the last 5 years was at a place called Agnes Bistro. Mm-hmm. And it's a French bistro. And I am not like a fan of just a pure, like, Julia Child's French cuisine.
Yeah.
Dean de France. My thing. Like, wasn't about that life. And then I went to Agnes Bistro and I ate the simplest one, which is going to make me forget what it is right now, but it's basically the bean platter. It's slow pork shank cooked in beans, white mm-hmm. beans. Mm-hmm. I completely forget what it is called. It's a very common dish. Mm-hmm. And I was like moved to tears. It was so good. And I was like, what in the... I just gave in, uh-huh. and I ate some Francophile food, which I would have totally poo-pooed any mm-hmm. given day.
Yeah.
And it was moving. So, Chuck, and Chuck will have good, like, you know, things to eat because he eats.
Yeah. I mean, that's the thing. Like, we all eat. I mean, there are definitely people that care less about food and for whom food is only, like, sustenance, basically. They don't care for the most part. But like everybody eats, like and most, I would say everyone or at least most people will have like a favorite food or a favorite story or something because it's so visceral. Like it's something that we, like there's so many feelings attached to it. Like it's if you have this like really amazing food, like it makes you happy and that feeling you remember forever and ever. And I think that's why that's why we love food. Like it's. There's a reason why we're so obsessed, honestly, with food sometimes.
It becomes emotional.
Yeah, exactly. All right. Thank you for being here. Maybe you can tell everyone where they can find you.
I'm all over the internets at Doc Rock, DocRock, and then the YouTube channel and the blog is now at Doc Rock Tips. That's Doc Rock with TIPS.
Nice. Very good. Yeah, and you can find me all over the web at thepatrice.com, like everything I do. And you can find this podcast on Twitter at foodieflashback and foodieflashback.com. And please don't forget, like if you like us, share and rate us on iTunes so more people will find this amazing podcast. And if you're interested, you want to, like you have a story to tell, you want to talk to me, you want to share something, then like reach out to me either on Twitter or like there's a form on the website if you want to, like if you feel like better doing that. That's fine too. And yeah, I think that's it. Thanks for listening, and we'll talk to each other next time.
Aloha.